Welcome everyone to Countering Global Counterinsurgency. My name is Michelle LeBlanc and I will be the chair for this panel discussion. I'm a member of both the Fredericton Peace Coalition and the Citizens Press, who along with the UNB and STU Social Justice Society and the Underground Cafe organized and sponsored this event. So our first panelist tonight is Jeff Brown. He's a UMB history professor, and he's going to speak on Canada's role in Afghanistan.
Okay, that's me. Can you hear me?
Yes?
Okay. Good. Well, I'm happy to be here today to say a few words about the Canadian intervention in Afghanistan. You should know at the outset, though, that I'm no expert on either Afghanistan or Canada, and I meant to say a moment ago the Canadian intervention in Afghanistan. I'm not an expert on Afghanistan or Canada. I've never been to Afghanistan. I don't know Pashto or Dari or Uzbek or any of the other languages spoken in Afghanistan. Afghanistan isn't my academic specialty here, nor is it, to my knowledge, the academic specialty of anybody at this university. I don't have any Afghan friends. I'd like to have Afghan friends, but I don't at the moment. Now, I'm in a little better shape with respect to Canada. Canada's not my academic specialty either, but I do live here. Some years ago, I married a Canadian, and I've come to know lots of other Canadians. And I can speak and understand at least one of Canada's official languages, and I just became a Canadian citizen. Now, it seems to me that becoming a citizen comes with a responsibility. And that responsibility, among others, as I see it, is attempting to educate myself about how my new country conducts itself in the world. Now, I have something of an advantage in this undertaking because I'm also an American citizen. And learning about Canada's international behavior requires, as a prerequisite, some understanding of the international behavior of the United States. Now, I've worked hard to cultivate this sort of understanding as an American citizen. I've spent a great deal of time and energy trying to make sense of how the United States works, how it became the way it is, why it conducts itself in the world the way it does. In fact, I became so fascinated with questions like this that in due course, I became a specialist in US history. I became an expert at trying to work these questions through. Now, history for me has always been closely tied to citizenship. Learning history and cultivating the skills that historians use has always struck me as a good way to do a better job of being a citizen. Citizens in democracies, as I see it, have certain fundamental obligations. They have to keep informed. They have to critically and rationally evaluate the actions that governments take on behalf of citizens. They have to engage in the free and open exchange of ideas and arguments. This, I would contend, is the lifeblood of true democracy. They have to encourage their elected representatives to act in ways that serve the best interests of the public at large. And they have to hold their representatives accountable when they fall short in this respect. So I've tried to do all those things, and I've also tried to encourage other citizens to do the same sorts of things, both in Canada and the US. That's one of the things that I think can be radical about teaching history in a university, teaching people how to be radical citizens. So all of this is to say that I come to you first and foremost not as an expert, but as a citizen, a dual citizen, as it happens, with some historical skills. I'm no authority, but I'm committed to attempting to understand the pressing issues of the day. So naturally, I'm concerned about Canada's role in Afghanistan, particularly its military role in Afghanistan. How did Canadian soldiers come to be there? What are they doing there now? What are their objectives? Is there purpose a reasonable one, or is it ill-conceived? What would constitute success for the Canadian mission? By what criteria would we measure its success or failure? How is this enterprise represented in the media? Does this representation stand up under critical scrutiny? What should I, as a citizen, do about this issue, if anything? These are the sorts of questions I've been asking, the sorts of questions that I would submit all responsible citizens ought to ask. Now, my inquiry is nowhere near complete. My conclusions aren't settled ones. They're provisional. They're open to revision. I'll probably revise them tonight. What I can say for sure, however, is that I haven't been reassured by what I've learned so far about Canada's role in Afghanistan. And what I'd like to do in the time that I have left is offer a brief summary of some of the essential aspects of this issue as I see it right now. First, some history. How did Canadian soldiers come to be there? Well, Afghanistan is often portrayed as one of those failed states, the sort of state that successful nations in the West ought to help turn around. We might go back a long way to find the roots of this failure. Of course, we might also interrogate the whole notion of a failed state. What constitutes failure? By what standards do we judge such things? But let's take a failed state as a given for the moment, recognizing that that conception may be somewhat problematic. And let's ask, how has Afghanistan come to be a failure, as these things are commonly understood in the West? Well, we can go back a long way. Afghanistan is a crossroads of Asia. It is the battleground of empires. It was occupied at various times by numerous foreign powers, from the Macedonians of Alexander the Great to the Mongols, and then for much of the 19th century by the British Empire. It achieved independence in 1919, and it operated as a semi-feudal monarchy until 1973. The monarchy was overthrown by a coup in 1973, and a nominally republican but actually repressive and quite ineffective government was established. And this was overthrown in 1978 by a communist coup, the so-called SAUR, S-A-U-R, rebellion, led by the Marxist People's Democratic Party, the PDPA. The U.S. immediately began to undermine this communist government. Remember, this is the Cold War. Every leftist insurgency anywhere in the world is interpreted as a offshoot of Moscow's grand conspiracy to control the world. So the U.S. started to undermine this government even before the Soviet Union actually, we say, invaded. They were invited, actually, by the government to enter Afghanistan in 1979. And in fact, there's pretty compelling evidence that the U.S. was trying to elicit that invasion by creating instability in Afghanistan. Now, the PDPA had a tough time. There were all sorts of internal divisions, all sorts of infighting. Marxist reforms alienated the rural and the religious population of Afghanistan. It's tough to set forth Marxist reforms in a country that's overwhelmingly rural and conservative religiously. The U.S. worked to fan this discontent. It worked to fan it into an insurgency, and it worked then to make the insurgency successful. The USSR worked to support the government and to defeat the insurgency, and it came into Afghanistan in force in 1979, and then there's a war. The Soviets and their Afghan allies are pitted against the Mujahideen, including Osama bin Laden, freedom fighters, as Ronald Reagan called them, funded and equipped by the United States through Pakistan. In 1985, in fact, Reagan received a group of Mujahideen leaders at the White House, and he called them, quote, the moral equivalent of America's founding fathers. The Soviets withdrew in 1989. This was interpreted as a decisive victory by the United States. The government that it had been trying to support in Afghanistan fell in 1992 to a coalition of Mujahideen warlords, a fairly fractious and brutal coalition. And after 1992, you've got this escalating spiral of civil conflict, chaos, corruption, unrest. The Taliban, mostly Pashtun Afghans from Kandahar, gained control in 1996. And at the time, this was seen as a very positive development. Government by warlords toppling each other had created a great deal of turmoil and trouble for the Afghan people, and indeed for the United States. And the Taliban takeover was regarded as the return of stability. Now, we all know something about the Taliban. They gained control in 1996 of Kabul. By the end of 2000, they control about 95% of the country. We know something about their brutal reign. We've heard about their ultra-strict interpretation of fundamentalist Islam with its draconian restrictions, its massive abuse of human rights, its horrendous oppression of women. We've heard about its willingness to harbor former Mujahideen freedom fighters who had become the sworn enemies of the United States, people like Osama bin Laden. Initially, the US was happy to work with the Taliban. Any regime that restored stability would be good for business. And the US was particularly interested in gaining access to the huge oil fields of Central Asia. They wanted to construct a pipeline from the Caspian Basin to the warm water ports to the south. But the Taliban weren't especially reliable as business partners, and internal abuses in Afghanistan became increasingly difficult to ignore. So in 1999, negotiations with the Taliban broke down, and the US began to plan for regime change. Note that this is before September 11th, 2001. Plans are already in motion for regime change in Afghanistan. In fact, initially the US was exploring the possibility of allying with Russia to oust the Taliban, essentially. Well, September 11, 2001 happens. The US now has the pretext it needs to oust the Taliban, and it begins to work on that forthwith. Now, things could have been different. Things might have been otherwise. The US might have seen 9/11 as a crime rather than a military assault. After all, the presumed attackers were not agents of a foreign state. They were non-state actors, as they say in the profession, I suppose. These criminals might have been dealt with through diplomacy and international law. The goal could have been the extradition of people who were culpable in 9/11 to stand trial in the US. We'll never know if these sorts of efforts would have worked because they were never pursued. The Taliban government attempted to explore the possibility of extradition, but this was rebuffed by Washington. Instead, Washington imposed conditions for Taliban compliance that it knew that the Taliban could not meet. Indeed, any sovereign government could not meet the conditions that the United States sought to impose on it. So the US went to war. In October of 2001, the US and Britain unilaterally launched a massive bombing attack on Afghanistan, and a bombing attack before which the Afghans were entirely defenseless. They had absolutely no defenses against it. And in the ground war that followed, the US supported the warlords of the Northern Alliance, the same faction that had created the chaos and misrule that had allowed the Taliban to come into power in the first place. And on November 12, 2001, the Northern Alliance enters Kabul. By December, Kandahar has fallen. And on December 5th, 2001, a new interim government is recognized by the UN. It's headed by an American favorite, a guy named Hamid Karzai, a former CIA operative who had funneled arms and cash to the Mujahideen in the war against the Soviets. I want to talk a little bit about the conditions of this war. The defeat of the Taliban came at an enormous cost to Afghan people who are already traumatized by decades of war and turmoil. Thousands of civilians were killed outright by the bombing and in the fighting that followed. Millions were displaced by the war. Conditions were horrible. No food, shelter, schools, work, medical care, security. The Bush administration made extravagant promises to rebuild Afghanistan. For a time, there was some hope that improvements would be made, but little has been accomplished since 2001 in terms of rebuilding. The U.S. became preoccupied with Iraq. It was content to put Afghan reconstruction on the back burner. Since 2001, the international community has spent $82.5 billion on military operations in Afghanistan and only about $7 billion on aid and development, most of this in and around Kabul. Military operations in the meantime have intensified over the same period. In 2001, there were about 23,000 Operation Enduring Freedom troops in Afghanistan. By mid-2006, there were over 30,000. Now they're operating under two categories. Some are under U.S. command. Some are under the command of the International Security Assistance Force, which is controlled by NATO. In practice, there's little distinction between these two categories. The U.S. Is sometimes in command of Canadian troops, and sometimes it's NATO. Resistance to the occupation, because that's what many Afghans are beginning to regard it as, and to the Karzai government, begins to increase over the course of that period. I want to talk for a moment about conditions now. The Karzai government now might be best described as a narco-kleptocracy. Corruption is rampant. To pay taxes in Kabul, you first have to bribe the tax collector. The drug trade is booming. This year saw the largest poppy harvest ever. Government institutions are deeply compromised. There are war criminals and drug lords hold positions of power in the Afghan government. Outside Kabul, a kind of warlord anarchy prevails. Sometimes this is relatively stable, especially in the north. Sometimes it's quite chaotic. The Taliban, or what we're calling the Taliban, are on the rise again in the south. Now, who are these people? General Rick Hillier calls them detestable murderers and scumbags. Who are they? Well, Taliban is what we hear, but Taliban doesn't quite cover it. There are some remnants of the original Taliban. There are some Afghans who are loyal to the former Taliban regime. There are nationalistic ethnic Pashtuns who are disgusted with the Karzai government. There are ordinary Afghans who are radicalized by neglect and oppression. There are criminal gangs, there are opium traffickers, there are mercenaries. The Senlis Report, an international organization that has recently done an exhaustive report of current circumstances in Afghanistan. You can find this on the web, and it makes revealing reading. I'll give you a quick quote from them. Current insurgents are Afghan people. Anti-government elements have been recruited from the growing number of people dissatisfied with the Karzai government or U.S. and NATO ISAF forces. In August, at a conference, Canadian Major General Andrew Leslie said, Afghanistan is a 20-year venture, but there are things worth fighting for, there are things worth dying for, there are things worth killing for. He was then asked why it would take 20 years. And he says, every time you kill an angry young man overseas, you're creating 15 more who will come afterward. It seems counterproductive to me. What's the real mission? Well, I would submit that the real mission has a great deal more to do with supporting and legitimizing U.S. foreign policy than it does with peace, security, and development in Afghanistan. Peace, security, and development is important, but this is secondary. It's important because The powers that be want to win the hearts and minds of Afghanistan in order to stabilize the situation. The goal is to provide the Karzai government with security and to extend the reach and power of the Karzai government. I've already told you something about what the Karzai government means for many Afghans. I just want to read a couple little pieces, and then I'll finish up because I'm told to stop. There's a big sign that so far I've managed to ignore, but I probably can't too much longer. Anyway, this is something written by a woman named Zoya, who's a member of RAWA, the Revolutionary Association of the Women of Afghanistan. And this was this is from a speech that she gave on October 7th of this year. She says, "Now 5 years have passed since the start of the U.S. war on terror in Afghanistan, which was trumpeted by the U.S. media to be for democracy and the liberation of Afghan people. But today, Afghanistan is still chained and burning in the fires of both the Taliban and the criminal Northern Alliance fundamentalists. The future of Afghanistan is in serious jeopardy. Considering the U.S. involvements in other countries and in the past 2 decades in our own land, most of our people know very well the hidden nature of this war. It was the U.S. government who supported Pakistan in creating thousands of religious schools from which the germ of the Taliban emerged, and supported jihadi fundamentalist groups with billions of dollars against the Soviet Union. Our founder, that's the founder of RAWA, Mina, had long ago warned that empowering such dirty and ignorant terrorists will not only pose serious dangers for Afghanistan, but for the people of the whole world. And the 9/11 tragedy confirmed this." She goes on to catalog the deteriorating situation and plea for an end to what she now regards as a foreign occupation that is not serving either the women of Afghanistan or the population in general. Okay, I'm going to stop for now. I'm going to listen to the sign, and I don't know whether we do questions now or...
No, actually, we'll be keeping the questions until the end.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.